Hello, and welcome back to the Land and Climate Podcast. My name is Alistair McEwen, and in this episode, I spoke to John Valiant, acclaimed writer and author of Fire Weather, an account of the brutal wildfires which hit Fort McMurray in Canada in 2016, and which has just this week been shortlisted for the Bailey Gifford Prize for nonfiction.
Things that are happening now were not happening in the 1990s, the 1980s, the 1970s. You know, you did not have actual EF-rated fire tornadoes. You didn't have pyrocumulonimbus clouds, which are these gigantic stratosphere-piercing fire smoke systems, firestorm systems. In the past, would generally occur over a volcano. Canada has produced more than 100 of these giant systems just this summer. And that's never happened on planet Earth, ever.
I started by asking John how he came to write Fire Weather.
It's a logical continuum in the case of my career, which started late, got into magazine writing in my mid-30s, and then very quickly got onto The Golden Spruce, which was my first book. And that really kind of set the tone for every book that's come since. So there have been three since The Golden Spruce. And all of them really focus on collisions between human ambition and the rigid limits of the natural world. And so it's those sort of two tectonic plates grinding against each other, if you will. Those stories often occur in dramatic fashion out on the periphery of human habitation, where the land, the wilderness, the energy of the earth is manifesting strongly and in an uninhibited way. And industries venture out there to capitalize on it in some way and run into some trouble. And then I try to find these kind of more isolated stories within that drama that bring out, you know, specific characters and characteristics. And all of them have a slightly supernatural quality to them. I don't read horror stories, but the horror is still out there and of interest to me. And then the supernatural qualities, you know, whether it's a golden tree or the way this tiger hunted this particular man or the way this fire behaved, all of them are so strange that it's hard to believe they're real. And yet they're all documented and in many cases, you know, videotaped and photographed, and these things really happened. They sort of push the bounds of what's possible.
And maybe you could take us through the first part of the book, which sets out Fort McMurray, and maybe tell us a little bit about the use of bitumen.
Canada is one of the biggest oil, in air quotes, producers in the world, and it's the United States' largest source of foreign imports. So 90% of Canadian imports into the U.S. come from Fort McMurray, Alberta, which is 600 miles north of the U.S. border in the boreal forest. So really, you can imagine Siberia. Think of the taiga in Siberia, transpose that to northern Canada. That's where Fort McMurray is. And underneath Fort McMurray is this huge bitumen deposit. And bitumen is tar. It's what you seal your driveway with. It's what you mix into aggregate to make roads with. And in the case of Fort McMurray, there isn't a lovely well or reservoir of liquid bitumen there. It's all saturated quartzite sand. It's almost inconceivably difficult to render. And the only way to render it is by using colossal, and I'm talking about billions of cubic feet of natural gas per day to melt it out of the sand. So that's what's going on in Fort McMurray. With gigantic bulldozers, they scrape off the forest and then they start scooping out this bituminous sand. They put it into these huge vats that are heated with inconceivable quantities of natural gas fired heat. They melt the liquid bitumen out, and then you still just have bitumen. You do not have a fuel. You don't even have a crude oil. So then it has to be heated again to render out the so-called fractions that are usable, you know, diesel and kerosene. And, you know, there's different fractions that come out of crude oil that we can then burn in various ways. Already, you've had to burn it twice. You've had to superheat it twice just to get something that is vaguely recognizable by an American refinery. And it's still such a dog that it's heavily discounted on the American market based against world prices for, you know, OPEC crude or a Gulf of Mexico crude. So you've gone to this enormous effort to create a second level, second tier product. And that's the Canadian bitumen industry. And it is profitable only because you basically get the land for free. You basically get the water for free. You get subsidized gas. There's no exploration cost because you know where it is. And when you have oil at above $50, $60, $70 a barrel, you can actually make a profit on this stuff. And so that's the Canadian petroleum industry. And frankly, nobody else would do it. It doesn't put Canada in a very good light. And in a sense, we're sort of still cutting down trees and killing beavers. It's the petrochemical equivalent to that. People in Canada really work hard and they're willing to put up with a lot of difficult weather. You know, it's 50 below zero up there sometimes. And these machines, these giant, giant plants that you can literally see from outer space operate 24/7 all year round, you know, in incredibly difficult condition. You know, there's a toughness and a rigor and an engineering prowess manifesting there. But for what? There's a lot of beautiful oil in the world that you don't have to go through this kind of trouble to access.
And there's this quite affluent economy that's now built around Fort McMurray too.
There is. I mean, this is really amazing to me. The average household income in Fort McMurray in 2016, this is 2 years after a severe global downturn in oil prices. You know, it really shocked the global market for petroleum products, obviously impacted Fort McMurray. Nonetheless, 2 years after that in 2016, the year this terrible fire burned through the city, the median household income was $200,000 a year. So as far as I know, that makes it certainly the wealthiest municipality in Canada. But and I think you have to go to, you know, Westchester, New York, or Greenwich, Connecticut, or Marin County in California to get comparable household incomes. And these are regular folks. These are truck drivers and electricians and boilermaker type people. But it's hard work and they're good at it. And it's under these very difficult conditions that are everything is just kind of supercharged, superheated, if you will, including the housing market, by the overwhelming presence of the petroleum industry. I mean, it's basically a petro colony, a five-hour drive through the wilderness from the nearest other city, which is Edmonton, Alberta. So it's really a remote, anomalous environment.
And can you then take us through a little bit of your story in terms of what actually happened in Fort McMurray in 2016?
So the boreal forest, you know, it's the largest forest system in the world. If you look at an atlas or a well-illustrated globe, there's this green wreath that basically goes around the top of the earth, goes all the way through Siberia. It's the taiga, you know, that huge forest system, goes all the way into Northern Europe, across Scandinavia, hops across the Atlantic, touches down briefly on Iceland, picks up again on Newfoundland in Canada, heads off into Labrador and all the way across Canada and into Alaska and back around again. And so it's really like this halo of green, and that's the boreal forest. And boreal is the Greek word, I think, for northern. It's a very flammable forest system. So it's got a lot of conifers in it, spruce and pine, but also birch and poplar and aspen. But the black spruce in Canada are excessively flammable. That's because they will only regenerate. The cones will only open and drop their seeds when they're heated to temperatures beyond that achievable by sunlight alone. They have to reach fire temperatures in order to tell the cones to pop, release the seeds. And what that tells the seeds is the canopy is now open. The trees have been burned down. The ground is now clear. And so it's your turn. That is how the boreal forest regenerates itself, by through fire. It's a phoenix among ecosystems. Totally normal, totally natural. The size of the fires that burn normally in northern Canada would beggar the imagination in a European context. You know, they would be front page news. And, you know, you got 1,000 square miles. It's really not a big deal to burn, and because it's so sparsely settled. And so this is normal anyway. But on May 3rd, 2016, instead of a normal temperature of maybe 10 Celsius, maybe 15 Celsius, we had 33 Celsius. Instead of a normal relative humidity of 25, 30, 40%, we had 11%. So now you basically have Death Valley, Southern California atmospheric conditions in a very flammable northern forest system. the effect on the forest is really like spraying it with gasoline. It's excessively more flammable. On May 3rd, 2016, we'd had this El Nino. There was a terrible drought, low snowfall, these excessively high temperatures. When you get that really low humidity, think about putting your laundry out to dry in Aberdeen and then putting your laundry out to dry in Phoenix. You're going to be all day trying to get those sheets to dry. They'll dry in 20 minutes in Phoenix. That's how it was in Fort McMurray on May 3rd, 2016. It was like Phoenix. That's what happens to the forest floor, too. All the pine needles, all the topsoil, the leaves, the bark, everything dries out like that. It's much more susceptible to combustion. On May 1st, there were five different wildfires burning around the city of Fort McMurray. Again, this is nothing new. This is the boreal forest. This is Canada. This is a really well-funded city. It's a very can-do province. A way to understand the province of Alberta, it's the Texas of Canada. You have the wide open spaces, you have the cattle, you have the horses, you have the oil, you have the evangelical Christianity, you have this alienation from the federal government, and you have this real independent can-do attitude. Well, that applies to wildfire fighters too. So they're out there battling this fire the way they always have, but always have isn't good enough because this is what I'm calling 21st century fire. 11% humidity, 33 Celsius. It's a different animal. So the techniques you used in the 90s aren't relevant anymore. They don't work anymore. So that's what they found out on May 3rd when the wind picked up. And so they're fighting this fire out in the forest, but now the embers are blowing right over their fire breaks, the fire lines that they plow through the forest with bulldozers. They've got sprinklers, they've got water bombers, they're doing all the right things. But it's so hot and so dry that the embers sail over the fire breaks, over the Athabasca River, which is a half a kilometer wide, and into the town. And because it's so hot and because it's so dry, those embers, they don't just land and fizzle, they actually land and ignite. So it's almost like the forest firebombed the city of Fort McMurray with embers. And you can have 50,000 embers in an acre. So you have five different fires starting in your backyard, and then some land in your gutter, some land in your soffit, some land on your porch, some land under your gas grill. And all of a sudden, there's fire everywhere where 10 minutes before you were looking at a plume over the tree line. Suddenly, it's all around you. And again, because of the dryness, because of the wind, these fires spread as if someone had sprayed the ground with gasoline, which nobody did. But it was so dry, it was a degree of flammability that no one was really ready for. And, you know, this is back in 2016, but we've seen this in Paradise, California. We've seen this in Lahaina. You in the UK saw this, I think, last summer in some of your communities. Everyone is shocked by how fast the fire moves. It's over there, and then suddenly my porch is on fire. And that's 21st century fire. And that's what happens when you goose the temperature up and drop the humidity down. These are these invisible thresholds that we're crossing right now. And we're crossing them in the oceans. Coral reefs are crossing these thresholds. The Loire River is crossing that threshold. Things are going dry. We're seeing sandbars. We're seeing fires. We're seeing rainstorms that we've just never seen before because we're crossing these climatic thresholds where you have a slightly different temperature and a slightly different humidity. And it really changes the dynamics for fire and for water. These fires that I wrote about, and Fort McMurray in particular, just seemed like an alarm was going off for me in 2016. If it could happen like that in Fort McMurray, the entire city was beset by fire for more than a week. The Great Fire of London in 1666 burnt for 5 days. You know, that was an epic, epic, world-class fire that will go down in history and be talked about forever. In Fort McMurray, a city of 90,000 temporary and permanent residents, the fire was in the community for a week, just probing it, taking neighborhood after neighborhood after neighborhood, day after day after day, and night after night. And that's another difference between 20th century fire and 21st century fire is it burns all night long because it doesn't cool down. We notice the highs when we're awake. Oh, it's so hot today. We broke another record. When we're sleeping, records are being broken too. It doesn't cool down as much. It's 20 Celsius. It's 25 Celsius. It's 30 Celsius at 3 in the morning.
you've first of all got some great way of describing how fire develops. But as well as that, you've got some really interesting testimonies from people who were involved and how they reacted to the fire. Part of your book talks about this Lucretius problem. Can you say a little bit about that?
The Romans and the Greeks, they figured out so much about who we are today and how we behave and respond to things today. And so Lucretius was a poet and philosopher. He lived in the first century BC, a Roman, and he observed that people tended to think the biggest thing that ever was the one that they had themselves seen. You go to the Fells or the Lake District and you see the mountains there, craggy and covered with snow, and those are big mountains. And those are the biggest mountains you may know. And then you go to the Alps, and all of a sudden, it's a whole other magnitude. And then you go to the Himalayas. What Lucretius was saying, he was saying, you know, the people generally think the biggest thing that is the one that they know, the biggest thing that they know. And so I applied that to the way people fight fires. We saw that big one back in 2011. We saw that big one back in 97. And so we know what a big fire is. Well, actually, you don't know what a big fire is when there's 11% humidity and 33 Celsius in the boreal forest, because it's another order of magnitude. But they're responding to it as if it was still 1998 or 2011. For the residents of Fort McMurray who encountered this fire, you know, first it was safely across the river where all the other fires were. You know, it's a big plume on the horizon. They see that every summer. They see that every spring. That's where it stayed for a couple of days. And then suddenly it was on their side of the river, engulfing the town. It's a whole nother order of magnitude. And metaphorically speaking, it's like the Lake District mountains suddenly became Himalayas and much closer to you. But it happened in a half an hour. What you have is these people encountering this, and it's literally too big to absorb and process intellectually, psychically, or emotionally. And so you have these people basically inhabiting this schizophrenic dissonance, which is, here I am living in Fort McMurray, having my day. I'm going shopping, doing my laundry, doing whatever I'm doing. And now there's this colossal presence that I can't explain, that I can neither limb nor scale. I think that really is a metaphor for how human civilization is now dealing with climate change. It is right there. It's colossal. It's in our community. And we're still trying to do our laundry and take our kids to school and have our day. Still trying to have a conversation with Alistair, you know? Can you just keep it down out there for just a little longer? Because I just like to finish my thought, please. You know, that's really where we're all at. What was amazing about Fort McMurray is it was just so dramatic and so colossal and so truly apocalyptic. The world ended for them that day. They escaped en masse. It was the largest, fastest evacuation due to fire in modern times. And people are driving through flames. They're driving through the kind of smoke that you need headlights to get through in the middle of the day, and you still can't see, and they don't know where it ends. It could be 100 miles. It could go all the way to the U.S. border. They literally don't know how big it is, and all the cell phones are jammed because everybody's trying to call everybody, and they're in this state of limbo with the kids, you know, screaming in the back seat and their dogs going crazy. So, you know, it was totally traumatic. And so the more I learned about that, I realized we need to wrap our heads around this, because this isn't going to be the last one. And sadly, you know, this, you know, the past few years have borne that out. And this particular summer, 2023, has been absolutely hellacious for Canada. And it's ongoing. You know, there are massive fires burning in Canada right now.
The responses to those fires don't seem to have been that different from the one that you've accounted for in your book.
The one thing we learned, and that is being practiced in Canada anyway, are preemptive evacuations. So people are realizing now, people are getting the message. A lot of people are reading this book in Canada and elsewhere, but people are also talking to each other. Fort McMurray was a national trauma. You know, everybody dialed into that and paid attention, and they realized that the evacuation was called late. And what's confusing, I think, for people is nobody died in the flames in Fort McMurray. And so Canada basically got a pass. They got incredibly lucky. The country, the province got incredibly lucky. And so then you can sort of lull yourself, well, we can handle this. You know, we're good. But then you look at Paradise, California, you look at Lahaina, You look at Little Lytton, British Columbia, which burned to the ground in half an hour in 2021, and two people died there. The fatalities are looming. It's a lot easier to die in a fire than a lot of Canadians think it is, and maybe a lot of British people. It happens really quickly, especially for elders. That's really one reason Fort McMurray succeeded. The demographic there is skewed toward young, strong, ambitious people who want to work 12-hour shifts, you know, 10 days in a row. There are not a lot of elders there, and they were able to move fast, and they had training and petroleum fire and all kinds of other disaster scenarios. But most communities don't have that. And to answer your question in a roundabout way, I think what they are doing differently is preemptive evacuation, but the fire is still coming into these communities. People still want to try to protect their homes. There has been some disastrous loss in Canada this summer. There have been 200,000 Canadians have been on the move, evacuated due to fire, tens of thousands more, and then tens of millions of North Americans have been impacted by really heavy orange sky, Blade Runner scale smoke. And no one's ready for the floods, no one's ready for the fires. We're playing this game of slow motion catch up that has to wade through denial. One thing I really wanted to bring up with you, Alistair, is not all denial is cynical or politically motivated. We really like our status quo.
I wanted to pick up the part of your book where you describe the early warnings about climate change as being kind of Cassandra-like, and relating that to, in your words, there was this capitalist impulse of the post-war period of the 20th century and beyond. Can you explain that a little bit more?
The groundwork for colonial capitalism, of course, was, you know, was laid by the East India Company, by the Hudson's Bay Company in the 16th and 17th centuries. This idea that you could just kind of swan into a place and basically plunder it. And, you know, the Spanish were doing the same thing in Latin America. It's been going on a long time. But after World War II, as oil, as liquid fuel really rose in prominence, and liquid fuel, besides being a really efficient energy, is also a really effective wealth generator. And it's why so many of us have our own cars, you know, why so many of us have our own homes. That was not the case in 1925. And things are really different now. And it all goes back to liquid fuel and the internal combustion engine. That really was a cataclysmic leap, a quantum leap from the coal-fired industrial world that we lived in the 19th century. Liquid fuel really changed the game and made that energy and that wealth accessible to so many more people. So we owe it a debt of gratitude. But at the same time, climate scientists, almost in parallel, kind of independent of each other, you know, you have engineers on the one hand trying to develop the automobile and make the internal combustion engine more efficient. You have early climate scientists in the 19th century, 1880s, 1890s, who now understand what CO2 does. They understand that, like water vapor, it retains heat more effectively than other components of the air. So the more CO2 there is in the lower atmosphere, the more heat our lower atmosphere is going to hold. This was understood by the 1850s. We've known it a long time. And the idea that human behavior could actually change the climate, you know, that was a big leap, certainly in the 19th century. But you take these Swedish scientists, Arvid Hogbaum and Svante Arrhenius, and there were others too, who extrapolated out. Okay, we know what CO2 does. We know that burning coal and burning fires create CO2. What would happen if we just sort of gamed this out on a bigger scale? Because we see this expanding. We see the world slowly industrializing. We see it energizing. And we know the atmosphere is finite. It's a closed system for the most part. So they just kind of followed it to its logical conclusion. And so they were already realizing, literally before the turn of the last century, that if we continued burning at that scale, which of course we have, and then some, we could actually potentially change the Earth's climate. We could actually heat it up the way giant volcanic eruptions have done in the past. That's what's happened. And then by the 1950s, the science was getting much more specific. Just the instruments were getting better. The people were pursuing. It was still a sideline in science, but there were some really brilliant people out there on the periphery, Gilbert Plass and Roger Revell and others who, you know, were household names in their day. They were quite famous people. By the 1960s, there were conversations with oil companies and with automobile companies. Guys, we're burning a lot of oil here. We're burning a lot of gas here. Everybody wants a car. A lot of people want to have two cars. This is moving globally, and there are going to be some impacts. This is when scientists began overlapping with industrialists and bankers and petroleum company CEOs and saying, this is going to impact the planet. This industry could impact the planet. And so petroleum companies, specifically Exxon, but others too, began doing their own science in the 1970s. Exxon did pioneering climate science. And this has been pretty well documented now. But in the 1970s, they became invested in this issue. And they, biggest, most powerful companies in the world, they can hire the best scientists. Those scientists did spectacular work. And they made predictions. And the predictions were that we were going to start to notice the impacts of heightened anthropogenic CO2 around the year 2000. That is when the actual heat impacts and heat retaining qualities of the atmosphere would change enough that we would start noticing it through the quote unquote noise of natural climate fluctuation. And that's exactly what happened. When you look at climate graphs, when you look at climate news around the late 90s, early 2000s, we start seeing these changes and we see changes in fire behavior. And that's why I call it 21st century fire, because things that are happening now were not happening in the 1990s, the 1980s, the 1970s. You know, you did not have actual EF-rated fire tornadoes. You didn't have pyrocumulonimbus clouds, which are these gigantic stratosphere-piercing fire smoke systems, firestorm systems. In the past, would generally occur over a volcano. Canada has produced more than 100 of these giant systems just this summer. And that's never happened on planet Earth, ever. We're in a new world that the petroleum industry made. And that's a reckoning, and we're two generations late. We've known literally since the 50s that this was a strong likelihood. And we knew by the 70s that it was a virtual certainty.
And I wanted to pursue a little bit what I think you end up saying towards the end of the book. Throughout, it's a very good philosophical and psychological analysis of human behavior in a way. I suppose the end of your book seems to suggest that maybe humanity will come close to its own destruction. I'm not sure if that's fair. Maybe you can go a little bit into that. But also, it's quite interesting in the sense that, you know, if we look at net zero now and the responses that there have been to climate change, if you look at resource extraction, for example, in relation to electric vehicles, there doesn't seem to be a huge change in the patterns of behavior around consumption.
It's heretical to talk about reductions. It's heretical to talk about degrowth, if you want to call it, or shrinking, or just lowering your expectations. And that's not for quality of life. It's for what you deserve to own and what you deserve to be able to burn. Because so much of what we do and what we are and what we own is dependent on combustion, is dependent on fire, you know? And so when you look at human civilization now, it's really a fire cult, basically. And it generates wealth for us, more for a small, tiny few than for the rest of us. But all of us are riding those coattails. But right now we're riding those coattails, you know, off a cliff, effectively. And petroleum CEOs have made it abundantly clear this summer that they have no interest in participating any attempt to reduce or change or even move toward renewables. Greenwashing is out the window. They're saying the quiet parts out loud now. And I have quotes from, you know, every major CEO stating this. You know, basically, we're here for the money and we're going to keep burning. And that's what we do. So for the rest of us, we're going to be seeing massive changes in the 21st century. A lot of it isn't going to be good. But something I think is really important to remember, I mean, first of all, the petroleum industry is the fire industry. The petroleum industry is a wholly owned subsidiary of fire. So that's who we're serving. You're serving fire. You're enabling fire. And we've enabled fire to burn with an intensity and at a breadth that it never has before in the history of Homo sapiens. So, you know, we created this. We've enabled fire as much or more than it's enabled us. And that's something to think about. The other is, The petroleum industry is an experiment. For everyone listening to this, and you and I, we were born into it. It feels normal. It's always been this way. Well, it hasn't. It's only been 150 years, which is the tiniest little sliver of our history, and even of the history of human civilization. So we are capable of living and flourishing in very different ways by very different means. We're also capable of nurturing the earth and tuning in to what it needs in order to flourish and generate abundance. That's how we got here, by being very sensitive and tuned to the needs of the earth. The fire industry has enabled us to disassociate ourselves from that and create this kind of illusion of control. Well, I can just heat my house and I can burn the forest down and create spaces for myself. I can protect myself. I can illuminate the darkness. I can do all these things with fire that allow me to create a very compelling illusion of separateness from the power and the needs of nature. And what nature is telling us right now is not so fast. I'm still in charge here. And as you empower yourselves with fire, you empower me. And that's what we're seeing in the floods and in the fires. We're seeing an empowered atmosphere that we've empowered, but it's really a mirror. This is what you've done. And it's coming back to a place where you live. And one of the reasons I wrote this book is because after interviewing people who went through the Fort McMurray fire, through the Redding, California fire tornado of 2018, I really don't want people to suffer that way. It's totally traumatizing. It's absolutely terrifying. It undermines your faith in everything. It's absolutely lethal energy that humans cannot combat against. There is nothing you can do against a fire tornado. That there's nothing they could do to keep that fire from attacking Fort McMurray from all sides for a week, for 7 days. The Great Chicago Fire burnt for 36 hours. The Hamburg firestorm, you know, was a night and a day. The only reason that kept burning is because they kept dropping the bombs day after day after day. That was a different situation, not a perfect analog, but the energy release was similar, and titanic, unfightable energy that projects radiant heat that causes cars to catch on fire 100 meters away, even when there's no flame. So that's what we're unleashing here. There's a message in that. And the first message is stop burning. But that's going to require, again, this kind of Lucretius-like barrier to be broken through. You know, well, we've always had fire. We've always had cars. We've always had a pilot light burning in the basement in our water heater. And we have to find a new way. We have the technology to do that, but it's, can we get over our sense of hidebound status quo and embrace the message that the earth is sending to us unequivocally, and embrace these technologies and ways of being that are more in sync with the vital needs of the ultimate life support system, you know, which is planet Earth. So that's a supreme challenge for us psychically, intellectually, and culturally. That's the 21st century. That's what we're going to be doing for the rest of our lives and the rest of our kids' lives, is mediating those tensions.
My thanks to John Valiant for his time. As usual, you can also find John's recommendations on further reading around his book, as well as a link to the book itself. And in case of interest, the prize ceremony for the Bailey Gifford Nonfiction Awards will be on the 16th of November, that's next month. Please do follow our podcasts if you enjoy them, and my colleague Bertie Harrison-Berninski will be back in a couple of weeks' time with another interesting interview. Thanks also to Vasco Kostovsky for producing this episode, and thanks again for listening.